trained with her countless times. He knew she was capable of taking care of herself and kicking major ass. And, this made him grin, don't forget the first time he'd set eyes on her. On the screen, Rachel looked over her shoulder, as if making sure no one else was within earshot. Her image vibrated with the ship's movement. There's something hinky about this place. I can't put my finger on it, but I can tell the others are feeling it too. Not much here but rocks and small mountains. No atmosphere, so it's not like anything alive is out there. But sometimes the shadows look, I don't know, funny. Like they move just out of the corner of your eye as we pass. Suddenly, she laughed. Listen to me, right? It's not like a baby. First time jitters, that's all. She looked over her shoulder again, and this time Hicks heard someone else speak, although he couldn't make out the words. Okay, gotta go. We're getting close to the mark. Love you. The screen flickered out, and for the first time in all these transmissions, Hicks heard himself whisper back, love you too. The last message came the next night. By military standards, it was late. If you're early, you're on time. If you're on time, you're late. And Hicks had been waiting for it, pacing in front of a silent television because he couldn't stand the mindless babble coming out of the actors' mouths. Every word seemed to cut into his already tattered nerves. The truth was he'd been walking the rounds in the small living room for almost an hour, way before Rachel's nightly transmission. But sometimes the shadows look, I don't know, funny. Like they move just out of the corner of your eye as we pass. He couldn't get those words out of his mind. He wasn't buying into her comment about it being initial mission jitters. Rachel wasn't like that. She was always the first one to react in an emergency. Even if it was just training, she was the coolest head and the steadiest hand, made the best decisions. Her brain would calculate the solution, her green eyes would focus on whatever steps were needed to do it, and that was it. Mission accomplished. There was no reason to think that wouldn't be the case here. Except, but sometimes the shadows look, I don't know, funny. Like they move just out of the corner of your eye as we pass. The comms chimed, and Hicks jerked around and stared at the computer across the room. Then he was there, and clicking on the icon, leaning forward, as if that could make him better able to hear his wife. Just a quick one, Dwayne. I shouldn't be taking the time to make this recording. Gunny will have my ass if he catches me. But I don't care. We're under attack by some kind of alien. We can't get a full sighting, so we don't have enough info to feed into the database and identify it. We think it's black. Well, everything around here is black. And big. We're shooting at shadows. Sometimes we hear these crazy screaming sounds. But other than that, nothing. The sensors show motion all around us. But we can't pinpoint anything. We sent out a 2-man forward patrol, but that was an hour ago. We haven't gotten a single thing back from them. Suddenly, gunfire erupted somewhere off screen. Rachel stood and swung her pulse rifle into position as someone, a man, first yelled and screamed. Hicks had never heard such a sound in real life. It sounded like the Marine was being burned alive. Another noise cut over it all, a shrieking that Hicks felt in his ears like nails being dragged across an old-fashioned chalkboard. It made him pull in and hunch in front of his computer, and he couldn't imagine what it was like in real time. His wife's rifle fired once, twice, a half dozen times. He could see her uniformed back and the way the rifle punched into her body each time. Abruptly, she turned, and her hand scrabbled for the keyboard. We're under attack! Something huge and dark rolled across the view of the camera, and Rachel leapt away. There was more gunfire, an impossible amount, more shouts, more screams, then nothing. Hicks watched helplessly, fists clenched, waiting, hoping, praying for it to be over, and for his wife to return to the recording console. A minute, then two, three, more. A hand, bruised and splotched with black-looking blood, flashed into view. Hicks had time to register the clatter wedding band that matched his own before Rachel slammed her hand under the send button. That was the last time Dwayne Hicks ever heard from his wife. 5 years later. Someone hadn't been paying attention. Corporal Dwayne Hicks stared at the orders that had just come through, thinking that it was just too good to be true, and shit like this never happened in real life. Some admin private first class's stupid mistake? Undoubtedly. Coincidence? Maybe. Destiny? Fucking A. His memories of the night of her last transmission were fragmented at best, crystalline at worst. When the transmission had stopped, he had careened out of his apartment with his phone plastered to his ear, alternately crying and shouting at his first sergeant as he cut a madman's route with his car to his headquarters. Then there were calls and conferences and video conferences, an endless array of bullshit that did not fix the fact that all contact with Rachel and her entire squad had ceased. And there was no distress call, no ship's locator beacon. There was nothing. Ever. Again. Private First Class Rachel Miller Hicks, along with the gunnery sergeant in charge, two corporals, and eight more PFCs, were officially listed as MIA. The brass in the Colonial Marine Corps flapped their lips, and the memorandums were written higher and higher up the chain until the issue stopped somewhere and just stayed there. After all, it wasn't the first ship the Corps had lost, and it certainly wouldn't be the last. It had been sent to investigate pirating, and the final ruling was that the crew had been hijacked and the ship likely brought down by superior firepower. Its locator beacon had been disabled, as it was stripped of usable parts. The crew was presumed dead, but until the required 7 years had passed, they would remain MIA. Hicks had lost track of how many emails and vid messages he'd sent trying to find out why Rachel's death, he had no doubt she was dead, hadn't been investigated. He didn't need to know what had happened, because he had seen it. And so had dozens of other higher-ups in the Corps. He'd been told to let it go, that while the Corps wasn't suggesting his wife or the other members of that crew weren't important, it was too risky and expensive to go after the corpses and the remains of a ship that far from the border of the Corps territories. When he'd demanded to know why they'd sent Rachel's squad in the first place, the response had always been the same bullshit. That's on a need-to-know basis. His sarcastic responses about needing to know had gotten him 3 NJPs for insubordination. His first sergeant had saved his ass each time, but the last one had been just that. The last. You've hit your 3 times the charm, Hicks. Yeah, it's fucked up what happened, but I don't have any answers for you. I know you won't forget it, but now you just gotta deal and move on. That had been 8 months ago, and Hicks had taken the man's advice to let it ride. On the outside. On the inside, beneath his I-don't-give-a-shit expression and calm blue eyes, he seethed. And now, he stared at the orders again. The letter and number of the destination meant nothing to him other than he knew it by heart, because he'd seen it on so much paperwork, and it was 4 parsecs on the other side of Beta Trianguli Australis. The mission objective was to recover equipment abandoned on a previous operation. He wasn't surprised to see there was no mention of bodies, the date of the first mission, or names. That was a screw-up, and a good thing. Had the names of the MIA crew not been left off, the database crosscheck would have 86'd him from being part of it, and he would have never known they were going back. The departure date was 8 days from now, and if you were a family man, that wasn't much lead time, considering the length of the deployment. But Hicks wasn't a family man. The potential for that had been stolen from him when his wife had been killed by someone, or something, in the same place these orders were sending him. 8 days felt like a lifetime. Hicks wished they were leaving tomorrow. Dwayne Hicks woke up from hypersleep with his dead wife's image in his mind, and the skin of his lips stuck together. He forced his mouth open and discovered his tongue tasted like leftover chicken skin after it had been in the garbage for a week. Every joint and muscle in his body fought his efforts to sit up, but it wasn't the first time he'd been through this. Around him, the other members of his squad were waking up with the predictable swear words and groans, while the gunnery sergeant, a burly man by the name of Maxwell, Gunny Max, who had an iron-gray flat top, was already in uniform and working the command console. Everyone in this crew was new to Hicks, and their ship was a medium-sized reclamation rig retrofitted for speed. It had gotten them to mission and in landing position in a little over 5 weeks. Travel time had improved since Rachel had made this her final trip.
"Let's go, boys and girls,"
boomed Gunny, as he stood and came over to pace in front of the sleeping pods.
"Get your ass going and your blood flowing. Gonna set this bucket down on the surface in 58 minutes and counting."
Private First Class Schmid hooked one leg over the edge of her pod and looked up muzzily as she scratched at her tousled dark hair.
"No flyby for Scunny?"
"Time is money, and the core is tighter than the high school bikini you don't fit into anymore, Schmid."
He flashed a toothy grin.
"The hell I don't,"
she countered, but she was already on her feet and swinging open her footlocker. Maxwell fixed his gaze on Hicks.
"Call roll,"
he ordered.
"Make sure everyone came out of hypersleep and work in order and get something fast to eat. Then suit up."
Before Hicks could reply, Private First Class Laugh cut in.
"A shower?"
"That's funny, Laugh," snapped Maxwell.
Someone, Vernon, choked, trying to hide a chuckle.
"Take a shower next month. We got a job to do."
"You heard, Gunny,"
Lance Corporal Horsley said quickly.
"You're down to 56 minutes.
"Respond when I call your name,"
Hicks said in a voice loud enough to be heard down to the end of the sleeping area. He yanked up his pants with one hand and pulled a clipboard from his footlocker with the other.
"And you'd better be bleeding out before you tell me you can't be ready in time."
He began going down the list of names as he finished dressing.
"Traxler."
"Yeah."
"Laugh, I already know you're fine."
"Addison."
"Here."
"I got you, Schmid."
"Strand?"
"Yep."
"Niza."
A good-looking blonde jerked her head in his direction, her blue eyes flashing.
"It's pronounced Nez," she said sharply.
Then she added,
"Sir."
Hicks grinned to himself. He always appreciated people who stood up for themselves.
"Right."
He ran down the rest of the names.
"Knight, DePert, Vernon, Haggerty,"
and got responses from each. By then, all were rummaging in their footlockers and focused on the upcoming landing.
"Weapons?"
asked Haggerty.
"Absolutely,"
responded Hicks. He shot a sideways glance at Gunny, but his superior didn't contradict him.
"Always."
So far, Hicks had done a badass job of hiding his emotions. But when the ship actually settled onto the bleak, dusty surface of the moon where Rachel had said her last words, he felt his heart rate triple, not just in his chest, but in his temples, that place where, at his angriest, he could always pick up the thud, thud, thud of his racing pulse. He actively inhaled, trying to calm his nerves, but he wasn't into that meditation crap, and this was just too big, too important. Gunny's voice ground through his helmet speaker.
"Hicks, what's up with you? Your vitals are through the roof."
"Just excited to be in the Corps, Gunny," he answered. "An adventure every day, every hour."
"Very funny. You gonna pass out on me?"
"Not this year."
Gunny didn't respond, but Hicks swore he could feel the tough old man's gaze across the comm waves.
"Airlock is tight,"
Private First Class DePert said on the main channel.
"Rear hatch opening in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The steamy sound of hydraulics filled everyone's comms as the ship's oversized rear hatch opened. The retrofit had made it wide enough to accommodate 2 dropships side by side, in addition to lining the loading area with enough light to power a small town. The problem with that was no one could see Jack past the line of illumination. There was brightness, and there was blackness.
"Why here?"
Private First Class Knight suddenly asked.
"What's out there?"
Time will tell, quipped Strand. We metal. Even over the comm, Private First Class Addison's alto voice came across as vibrant. A striking and tall African-American woman, Hicks thought she was more suited to being an actress than a jarhead. That opinion notwithstanding, he wouldn't want to face off with her in a fight.
I did a scan for near-vicinity metal and hit triple cherries. It picked up something that's either big or in a whole lot of pieces.
Could be a ship, Vernon put in. That's what we're after, right?
Not much history on this mission, Nezza said, but it seems pretty obvious we're after whatever we can salvage after a crash.
The question is, how long ago did it happen?
This ain't the time for chit-chat, Marines.
Gunny Max's voice drowned out anyone else's comments.
Power up your suits and make sure you have enough push to stay on the surface. Anyone who thinks it's funny to free float gets 100 push-ups for every second they don't have both feet planted. Understand?
The spattering of affirmative responses seemed to be enough. So Gunny said,
Move out, and somebody get a spotlight out there. I can't see shit on the vid screen.
Strand strode to the front of the group and swung a high power light to the place. The harsh cone of illumination swelled, then disappeared into a blackness that seemed absolutely endless. With no atmosphere, not even dust floated in front of them.
Fail,
Lance Corporal hoarsely said. It was probably meant as a joke, but that failed too.
Let's go, Hicks ordered. Strand, you're with me. Traxler, come up front with the radiation detector. Addison and DePert to the left, Vernon and Haggerty to the right. The rest of you spread out and flank us. Keep it tight.
It didn't take long to cross the line where the lights from the ship stopped helping. What they got from the spotlight wasn't much, and the small but powerful lights on each side of their individual helmets didn't seem to help. To Hicks, the lifeless moon in front of them still looked gray and black through his amber-tinted solar visor. They had sat down in a decent-sized flat area between small, jagged mountains. Scattered around them was evidence of meteor strikes in sizes varying from a couple of meters to a quarter mile across. It was stark, and, like most uninhabitable, airless moons, coldly beautiful. They moved forward in silence, until Hicks held up his hand.
Where are we headed out here, Gunny? I don't see anything besides dirt and hills.
After a few seconds, Maxwell replied,
Go straight another 300 meters. The scan says there's metal there. If it's been here a while, you might have to dig to find it. But it's definitely on the screen.
Roger, he said.
So the Gunny had no back info on the mission either. Hicks gestured, and the crew followed as he moved, monitoring their progress on the tactical GPS on his wrist. He'd managed to calm his hammering heartbeat, but he still felt hyper-alert and edgy, ready to jump. His thoughts were spinning, not only with memories, but with questions. If only he'd been able to get the data from Rachel's last mission, the exact location where her ship had set down. If this moon had really been a place for pirated ships to hide, there was no guarantee that the ship, assuming that's what it was, they were coming upon, was hers.
I'm picking up trace radiation, Trexler said. Not much, though. It seems pretty dissipated.
Is it safe? Hicks asked.
Yeah. For this amount, we're plenty protected by our suits.
It does mean we're getting close to whatever it is.
There, Strand said suddenly, at the base of that hill.
His voice trailed off, and he slowed.
What's behind it?
Hicks took the spotlight from Strand, aiming it high and over the dirt-covered metal edges that rose in front of them. He kept moving, closing the distance, until he was able to get a definitive visual on the object. Scratch that. Objects. That receded into the dark.
Another ship, he said.
More than one, in fact.
Gunny, you hearing this?
Yeah. Any sign of activity?
Negative, Hicks replied.
Are the hulls damaged?
I can't tell from here.
We're moving in.
Hicks motioned to the others, and they advanced cautiously, knowing without being told to watch on all sides. No one broke radio silence, focusing instead on their surroundings. When they were 10 meters from the first ship, Hicks stopped, and the rest of them followed suit. No doubt about it. This was Rachel's ship. The Paradox. Hicks knew the mechanics of it by heart, and what it looked like from every possible angle, including the interior. He'd had half a decade to burn the specs into his brain. It looked like it had set down properly. No crash damage, but there were darker spots at random places on the hull and starburst patterns. Those could mean it had taken fire, but they weren't large enough to have come from another ship. Small arms fire?
Hicks!
Damn it. The vitals monitor on his suit was betraying him again.
I'm fine, Gunny.
Before Maxwell could say anything else, Hicks pointed at Vernon and Haggerty. You two head around the stern. See if there's any penetration damage to the hull. Addison and DePert will check the nose and anything behind it. I want three of you to go inside with me. Schmid, Nezza, and Knight formed up next to him, and Hicks led the way to the ship's closed entry door. Max, the ship's name is Paradox, and the main entrance door is sealed. There's a keypad to the right of the door. Can you find the code?
Give me 30 seconds,
Max replied, but he had it in under 15. Hicks punched it in, and they brought their weapons up automatically when the door slid to the side. There was no sound of air releasing, and inside the ship was as black as a pool of tar. No console or equipment lights, no backups. It was obviously still power, but someone had purposely killed the lights. Strand was there with the portable spotlight before Hicks had to ask for it. Hicks took it and lowered the intensity so it didn't overpower everything, then shined it around the entrance and into the space beyond. There wasn't much to see. No bodies, no weapons. Except, is that blood? Hicks swung the light back in the direction that Schmidt was pointing, at another hatchway, also closed. The glow ran across a black stain that started at the simple toggle switch on the right side of the hatch and ended in an elongated dripping pattern on the floor.
I want to check in from both exterior teams right now, Hicks barked into his mic.
Addison's distinctive voice came back immediately.
We're good.
Roger that.
Vernon's voice was cut a little by static, but he sounded calm and confident.
I want both recon teams back to the entrance, Hicks ordered. What's your status?
Maxwell asked.
We're on high alert,
Hicks replied, switching the channel so everyone heard.
It's hard to tell in this light, but it looks like there's blood inside.
He felt the jump in his pulse, but his voice was level and strong, and Hicks was proud of himself as he said the words. After 5 years, he knew he wouldn't find Rachel alive, but hope was a hard thing to completely extinguish.
We're moving in, he said. Switch the night optics. I'm going to leave the spotlight at the door. Spread out and keep your weapons ready. But no one moves out of sight of another team member. Recon teams, what's your position?
We got you back,
Haggerty replied.
Addison and DePert are in sight. When they get here, we'll all come in behind you.
Let's go.
Hicks put the spotlight down next to the open door, positioned so that most of its light shone outside. Then he switched his view to Knight and moved forward. When he got to the stained switch by the hatchway, he checked to make sure the rest of his team was ready, then pushed it. Although no green light came on to indicate it was responding, the door opened. More blackness. Not a single glow from anything to break the fuzzy green vista in front of them. There were, however, darker splotches here and there along the floor and walls, some splattering, others trailing. Hicks looked down and saw that he was standing in the center of a particularly large patch of it. The others probably didn't need to be told that there was no longer any doubt that it was blood.
Sir?
Knight was whispering, as if there was something in here that could hear them.
Let's go, Hicks said, and stay frosty.
Without being told, Schmid took point, crouching slightly, her pulse rifle forward and ready. The area in front of them fanned out into a command center that looked virtually destroyed. No wonder the ship had never gotten off the ground again.
Barely discernible levels of radiation,
Trexler told him quietly.
But I think there's a body. Check that. More than one under that smashed console.
Schmid and Laff angled toward it. Hicks followed, his heart suddenly banging inside his ribs. There was nothing he could do to slow it. He expected Maxwell to say something about his vitals at any second, but Gunny didn't break their focus. With night vision greenwashing over everything, there was no way Hicks could match what was in front of him to his memory of the grainy black-and-white vid messages that Rachel had sent him. Besides, his gaze had always been on his wife's face. One of the Marines said something, and Hicks realized he hadn't heard the words over his own rapid breathing.
"Come again?"
he managed, fighting not to stutter. Inside the temperature-controlled suit, stress was making him sweat, and beads rolled into his eyes.
There's not much left of the corpses, Laff repeated. Freeze-dried skin over bones, but there are names sewn into the uniforms, so we can ID them that way.
Hicks felt each word like a hammer blow in the center of his chest. Laff glanced at him, then continued.
They went down fighting, but we just don't know who.
Or what, Drexler said. Hicks scowled and turned toward the PFC.
Where's that coming from?
Drexler lifted his hand.
Look at that, sir.
They all looked to where his gloved finger was pointing, at another hatchway on the other side of the room. It was far enough so they could barely make it out, but the doors didn't look like they were completely closed. There was no halfway position, so it must have malfunctioned.
We'll check that in a minute, Hicks said hoarsely.
He inhaled deeply, then made himself step forward so that when Private First Class Laff stood, he could see the dead Marines on the floor. His eyes focused, and for a minute, everything. The Paradox, his crew, his life spun away. Then it all came back into dreadful reality.
Rachel, he whispered.
His voice was just low enough to not be clear. The right half of his wife's skull was caved in. There was no way to tell if she'd been bludgeoned with something or shot, although both hands still clenched her pulse rifle. Her dried face bore no expression but death. Tightly drawn skin, deep holes instead of eyes, lips shriveled to nothing over a still beautiful set of teeth. Hicks knelt and smoothed out the dust-laden name tag on her chest.
"Oh, God," Schmidt said. "Are you related to him?"
"Her," Hicks said automatically. His gloved hands were clunky as he eased her fingers, so dry and thin, away from the barrel of the rifle, then slipped off the wedding ring.
"Sir?"
Schmidt's tone clearly conveyed she had no idea what he was doing.
"She was my wife,"
Hicks said, as he unzipped a pocket and tucked the gold band inside. He touched Rachel's dust-laden hair a final time, then got back to his feet.
"Hicks, how the hell did you get pegged for this mission?"
Gunny Maxwell demanded in his ear.
"No idea, sir, but I'm glad I did. At least I can put an end to the waiting."
No one said anything for a long moment. Then someone, Hicks couldn't tell who because his head seemed temporarily full of fuzzy white noise, asked,
"How long has she been gone?"
The noise fell away, and Hicks answered in a wooden voice, "She and her crew went missing 5 years ago."
"Jesus,"
Addison said quietly.
"I'm so sorry."
Hicks cleared his throat before the others could chime in.
"Let's go," he ordered. "Right now, we need to check out the rest of this ship and make sure we're all safe."
He forced himself to turn his back on his wife's body and strode toward the hatch on the other side of the room.
"We'll start in here."
His crew followed, and although they'd never been on a mission together, everyone moved exactly as they should. The hatch was jammed with only about 4 inches open, just enough so they couldn't see a damn thing, even with night vision.
"I got this," said Lance Corporal hoarsely.
He went back across the room, and after a minute, returned with a piece of metal long enough to use as a pry bar. 15 seconds later, the door grudgingly slid aside. Schmid eased forward, taking point again. Hicks and the others followed her into the part of the ship that contained the hypersleep pods, partially recessed into one wall in a long line.
"There's damage in here, too," Schmidt said. "Looks like a firefight.
but I don't see any bodies.
The pods were empty, but most of the transparent covers were shattered or speckled with the blast patterns of bullets.
Gunny, Hicks said. You reading me?
Roger.
Can you do an infrared scan of the ship?
Already initiated it. Not showing any signs of life.
I think whatever caused this is long gone, Horsley said.
Maybe, Hicks said. But keep your guard up, just in case.
Private First Class Nezza, followed by a couple more Marines, had moved down the pods, inspecting each one. Now they were at the end, where the walls held upright storage units that were spaced evenly apart. They lined the walls farther than the night phase of their visors could penetrate.
There's some kind of stuff on the floor back here, she said. It's sticky.
Hicks and the others joined them, staring downward. Lance Corporal Horsley still had the makeshift pry bar, and he ran it across the flooring.
On the surface, yeah, but it's hardened beneath it. It's not even. It's rounded, like coils.
It's not just on the floor, said Addison. Look overhead. It's everywhere.
Knight had put a hand on the wall as he walked. Now he pulled it away and watched as long strands of the substance came with it, clinging tenaciously to his gloves.
What the hell is this stuff?
Hicks frowned.
Let's...
His voice dropped away as something moved in the blackness behind Nezza. Something big and fast.
Her sudden shriek cut into their speakers like a blast of feedback, loud enough to make some of them clap their hands against their helmets. Even so, they surged toward her, but before they could get anywhere close, Nez's pulse rifle fired. The discharges arced left across the ceiling, then came back to the right, this time at chest level. The chamber erupted in smoke, shouts of surprise and fear, and blasts of blinding white in their vision. Get down! Hicks shouted as he hit the floor and rolled. It's reflex! His back thudded hard against one wall, and he grunted, then tried to focus on the far end. Nothing in front of him made sense. It looked like giant dark worms were coming out of the spaces between the storage units. Everything was happening fast, and he couldn't stop on any one thing. They were in the midst of a full-on battle, but Hicks had no idea what they were fighting.
Report! Max was screaming in his ear. I'm losing vitals on team members! Damn it, Hicks! Report!
Almost in response to Maxwell's orders, another sound scissored into Hicks's ears, a monstrous combination of a hyena's scream and an elephant's roar. He screamed and scuttled backward, instinctively trying to get away. His hand slapped against someone's sleeve, and he grabbed at it, dragging the unidentified Marine with him. His team was retreating, fighting for their lives, but from his position on the floor, Hicks couldn't fire at anything without shooting his own crew members.
Pull out! He yelled. Marines! Get out now!
The Marine closest to him, Haggerty, turned to flee, but before she could take a single step, something yanked her into the air and slammed her against the ceiling. Her rifle discharged as she tried to hold on to it, and two more of his team jerked as rounds tore through their suits and into flesh.
Hicks, are you there?
Maxwell's voice bellowed into his earpiece, mingling with the screams of something unknown and Marines dying.
What's going on down there? Your numbers are dropping!
Under attack by unknown combatant, Hicks managed to respond.
He sucked in oxygen, then yelled as loud as he could,
Marines, retreat now!
He tried to scramble backward on his butt, but the person he was holding didn't move. Hicks flipped onto his side and got enough of a hand on the other's suit to turn it to face him. The smudged name tag on the suit read Trexler, but there was no protective visor in the helmet anymore. Just a black, wet hole. Another hideous, animalistic scream shot through his earpiece. Hicks let go of Trexler's body and low-crawled forward. He wanted to go back and fight, see if he could get any more of his team out. But a fast look over his shoulder made him realize that was impossible. Pulse rounds were zigzagging through the chamber, but the rounds were decreasing, and the origin directions were all wrong. Upward from the floor,
ricocheting dangerously off the ceiling. Only one Marine was still upright, legs wide, rifle spitting defiantly into the darkness. Hicks struggled to rise, and a bright knot of pain shot through his left calf. Something. A round. A sharp piece of metal. Who knew? Had penetrated the muscle. The suit had auto-sealed around it, but there was no way he was putting weight on that leg. One hand reached and found the edge of a sleeping pod. He grunted and rose, bringing up his rifle and aiming it at the smoke and tracers to the right of the other Marine. The size and stance registered in his brain as Private First Class Addison. Before he could squeeze the trigger, something too fast for him to identify lunged at her. Her rifle went flying into the shadows, and her long, lean body bent backwards almost in half, as whatever now owned this ship dragged her away. "Hicks! Get out now!" Maxwell screamed in his ear. "There's no one to save! You're the only one left! Get out!" For a precious second, Hicks was so shocked he couldn't move. His whole team was gone? Then instinct kicked in, and he swung around and lurched toward the broken hatch door. The line of hypersleep pods made the way seem impossibly long. He lost track of how many times he fell, until he finally just stayed down and dragged himself along the floor. When he made it through, he saw something move in the far side of the chamber, something oversized and black rapidly sliding toward him. This wasn't the time to identify it. Hicks pushed up and over the lip of the faulty hatch door and reeled across the command center room like a drunkard, rocking from side to side when his bad leg wanted to buckle beneath him. Somewhere to his right was Rachel's body, but he couldn't think about that now, not if he wanted to live. His night vision module was damaged, and the green view in front of him was sizzling in and out, in and out. He had to make it to the other hatch before it died on him completely, and he couldn't see anything. Hicks felt the creature come up behind him, just as he lunged through the hatch and slapped his hand against the toggle switch on the flip side of the wall. The door slid closed, and he leaned against the metal, gasping, and something brutal and huge slammed into it from the other side. The impact flung him away from the door, and Hicks landed on his back with the wind knocked out of him. For a moment, all he could do was lie there like a stunned, upside-down turtle, listening as the interior hatch door was beaten by a monstrous force. Finally, he shook his head to clear it and scrambled backward, turning as he went until he was upright and staggering forward. Behind him, the metal shrieked and started to buckle. It wasn't that thick, and it wasn't going to hold. "The code!" he shouted. "Max, I need the code for the exterior hatch! It's already open!" Gunny shot back. "Why, I have to close it!" Hicks launched himself through the open door and ended up skidding to his knees on the dusty moon surface, right calf pulsing with pain. "Right now!" He twisted up and back, slamming his palm against the side of the ship, shaking as he waited. His night vision was still wonky, and his head was ringing, but he could have sworn he heard metal being wrenched apart. "Max, I need it now!" It took Gunny another 3 seconds, a tiny slice of time that felt like eternity, and then he read it off. Hicks punched it in and got a red light. He'd mistyped. "Say again!" he yelled, as the sputtering field of green that was the entrance bay of the Paradox shimmered with movement. "Again!" Maxwell repeated himself, slowing just enough for Hicks to punch in the code correctly this time. Hicks had the sensation of something coiled and black rolling toward him. Then the heavy exterior hatch closed. There was a muffled boom as whatever was on the other side hit it, then hit it again. But this was the exterior door, designed to withstand human warfare in the vacuum of space. It held. Lethal non-human organic life form of indeterminate origin and physical description. That was what Gunnery Sergeant Maxwell put on all the reports, in spaces with labels like cause of loss of life and
reason for failure to reclaim assigned resources, and justification for aborting mission. There was no collaborating their stories, because he and Maxwell told the God's honest truth about what happened. And the video feed files from Hicks and the 11 other dead crew members supported their statements. Once the battle began, the vids were flush with screams and pulse rifle shots, but they were lousy with visual details. Flashes of light, rolling shadows, the impression of something huge and vast and dark, but that couldn't be pinpointed. There had been an uneasy question-and-answer session when Hicks had been facing officers so far above his pay grade that any one of them could have pointed a finger and ended his career. But again, he had just told the truth. "Corporal Hicks, why didn't you tell a superior officer that your wife had been on the Paradox?"
"Because I wanted to try and find out what happened to her, sir."
"And did you?"
"Yes, sir.
She was killed by..."
Again, that 11-word narrative.
"A lethal, non-human organic life form of indeterminate origin and physical description." In the end, the matter had gone all the way up the chain of command to their lieutenant colonel before being closed out. The status of his wife and the rest of the Paradox's crew were changed to killed in action, and Gunnery Sergeant Maxwell deployed somewhere else. Hicks returned to his usual squad to find his NCO furious that Hicks had gotten the orders to be on the squad that reclaimed the Paradox to begin with. Since the NCO was an E6 who was perpetually pissed off at the world, life was normal. Finally, Hicks had put an end to the mystery that had been his wife's disappearance. But he didn't have closure. Far from it. Sometimes at night, he would sit at his computer and re-watch the video messages that Rachel had sent him, her wedding ring rolling between his thumb and forefinger. Those were the nights Hicks would cycle from her first message to the last. That one he studied, his blue eyes narrowed and sharp, over and over. Even as he replayed his own experience inside the ship that had become her coffin. Those were the nights that Corporal Dwayne Hicks, his expression outwardly calm, would look from the screen to Rachel's wedding ring in his hand. Those were the nights that he would fold his fist around it, squeezing so hard that the edges cut into his flesh and his palm bled onto the gold metal. It was still out there. Someday, somehow, you would get the chance to find and kill the creature that had murdered his wife.
Blowback by Christopher Golden. Dietrich had never puked on a dropship before, and she hoped today wouldn't change that. She held on to the safety bar across her chest and tried to take even breaths, but the fact they were in free fall through the thick friction atmosphere of an alien moon didn't help. The dropship shuddered so hard it felt like it might break apart, so hard her bones seemed to crash together. She glanced over at Private Malenka, saw the girl's ashen pallor, and figured it might be a race to see who could vomit first. At least Jette Malenka would have an excuse. The girl was 19 years old, and this was her first drop outside of a simulator. Dietrich's only excuse would be too much whiskey the night before. Way too much whiskey. She kept her jaw tight, breathed through her nose, and tried to look straight ahead without focusing on the person sitting straight across from her, Corporal Tim Stenbeck. Dietrich didn't want to look at Stenbeck because then she'd remember the taste of whiskey on his lips and the guilt that had burned through her when she had woken up this morning in his bunk. She and Stenbeck had been involved for a while. You couldn't call it dating. They'd eaten and drunk and slept together for a few months, but that had ended nearly 7 weeks ago, with the exception of last night. It had been a blip on the radar, a foolish mistake, and she still felt the burn on her face from his stubble. It was a strangely pleasant sensation, which only made her feel worse. She had been the one to end it, bored with him and worried that he had started thinking long-term, thinking he might be in love. It hadn't been fair to him, what happened last night. She was afraid it might give him ideas. But then he had been the one to bring the bottle of whiskey to her door. All she'd done was let him in. Dietrich breathed through her nose, rode the dropship down, waiting for the moment when gravity would reassert, when Khan would take over the controls from the pilot seat, and then would try to land this crate on a rocky plateau in an inhospitable atmosphere on a planet that had already killed most of two research teams. The Colonial Marines weren't here for research. They were here to make sure the third team of scientists Weyland Yutani planned to send might have time to build themselves a compound before the local fauna, whatever the hell these aliens might be, could turn them into chum. Mind wandering, Dietrich scanned the faces of her squad. Spunkmeyer, Hicks, Hudson, Vasquez, Frost, Malenka, Wurzbowski, Crow, Zeller, Sergeant Apone, and their mission CO, Lieutenant Emma Paulson. All good Marines, and that included the one face she had refused to see, Stenbeck. Now she let herself see his face, unsurprised to find him watching her. Stenbeck gave her a nod as if to assure her all was well, that he was a big boy and knew where things stood between them. She still felt a little guilty, but maybe she didn't need to. After all, they'd both had a hell of a night. Dietrich gave him a nod. The dropship jerked upward as Khan took the controls. Bile surged up the back of her throat, but she fought it back down, counted to 10, and then exhaled. The dropship kept moving through the atmospheric soup, but now she could hear the rasp of the dusty air scraping the hull as they flew, and she knew it was almost over. "God damn, what a ride!" Hudson yelled. "Let's do it again." Many of them laughed. Hicks patted Malenka on the knee, but the girl's ashen pallor had improved already. "Hell with that," Vasquez said. "I'm already bored with this op. Can we just go out and kill whatever we're supposed to kill, get this bug hunt over with?"
"Belay that shit, Vasquez," Sergeant Apone growled. "We're gonna set a good example for our greenie today. Private Malenka needs to see how this unit operates so she can learn how you've all survived together this long.
Which means you and Hudson and Wurzbowski and Stenbeck are on notice right now before we even hit the surface.
We do this quick and by the book, is that clear?"
"I hear your voice in my sleep, Sarge," Vasquez said, glancing around at the rest of the unit. Only Hicks didn't smile. Always focused on the fight to come, that guy.
"What's that?" Apone barked. "I said, yes, sir, Sergeant, sir." "Damn right you did," Apone said.
Vasquez and Dietrich exchanged a knowing look. Half the time, Vasquez only said the things she did in order to get a rise out of Sergeant Apone. The man wasn't much older than Dietrich herself, but he had a grizzled air about him, partly due to the bushy black mustache he always seemed to be smoothing down, that made him seem like everybody's disapproving father. Dietrich knew from late-night conversation that Vasquez didn't have a high opinion of fathers and couldn't resist pushing Apone's buttons. It was odd to hear Apone lumping Stenbeck and Hudson into the same list of troublemakers. They had been friends once, best of, but that had been before Stenbeck and Dietrich had hooked up. After that, there'd been a chill between them, sometimes turning into open aggression. Dietrich had never understood it, but she had to admit to herself that it was part of the reason she had broken things off with Stenbeck. Her own friendship with Hudson had broken down because of the way the two guys had been at each other's throats, and she hated having that tension in the unit. Since she'd stopped sleeping with Stenbeck, things had mostly gotten back to normal, though some of the uneasy tension remained between the two men. She wondered if Hudson had heard them together last night, wondered what the hell his problem was to begin with.
"Think you could fill us in now, Lieutenant?" Hicks asked, turning toward Paulson. "I know this op is need to know, but we're practically on the ground."
Lieutenant Paulson frowned, the expression tugging at the thin white scar that cut across her mouth. She ran the palm of her right hand over her shaved scalp and then glanced up toward the pilot seat.
"How long till touchdown, Corporal Khan?"
she asked. Khan glanced at an instrument panel, hands on the stick.
Touchdown in 3 minutes or less.
The lieutenant nodded slowly, contemplating, and then turned to look at Hicks. Dietrich read irritation on Apone's face and wondered how much the Sarge had been told about their mission. Wondered if that irritation came from what he knew or what he didn't know.
We're about to land on Clytemnestra, a moon orbiting Festius in the Pollux system, Lieutenant Paulson said. Ice blue eyes, sharp and bright in the otherwise gray cabin of the dropship.
The rest of what I'm about to say is classified. You're not to repeat it to anyone. If you do, you'll be charged with...
corporate espionage, Dietrich said. We know. Maybe Malenka doesn't know.
I know, the young private replied, the tight, short curls on her head trembling as she turned to look at Dietrich. Sometimes we're military, sometimes we're a private task force. That's what happens when the armed forces have a corporate sponsor, but I know what I signed up for, Cynthia.
Dietrich flinched, held up a hand to forestall the girl's hostility.
Back off, kid, I'm just looking out for you.
Malenka nodded. Thanks for that, she said, brushing Dietrich off.
Put a leash on it, both of you, Apone ordered. Private Malenka, I'm glad you know what your role is, and very happy you don't feel like you need babysitting, 'cause you're not gonna get any from this group.
I can hold up my end, Malenka said curtly.
See you do, Apone replied.
Stenbeck laughed and elbowed Spunkmeyer.
Looks like Vasquez isn't the only rabid dog on this squad now.
That's enough, Lieutenant Paulson said. Vasquez murdered Stenbeck with a glance.
This bitch'll bite your damn balls off.
In one bite you can bet your ass, Hudson said appreciatively.
Asshole.
Enough, Apone shouted. You all want to know what you might be dying for today or not?
That quieted them down. All right, Paulson said. Back to Clytemnestra. The company's exploration drones found an element on this moon that will revolutionize interstellar travel. They've been working for decades on better engines, better fuel. 11 years ago, they theorized that a combination of two elements, let's forget the chemistry and just call them salt and pepper.
You don't think we could understand the chemistry? Frost asked, wounded.
Sergeant Apone smoothed his mustache.
Shut it, Frost. She knows you can't.
Paulson held up a hand to silence the laughter that followed and forged onward.
The problem is that every time the researchers tried to combine salt and pepper, they blew up their lab. What they needed was some third element that would stabilize that mixture. From the reports I've read, they tried over 2,000 combinations before they gave up a few years ago. But 11 months ago, Weyland-Yutani drones found a gas in the atmosphere of this moon that they are certain will render those combustible elements inert. If they're right, they think they'll have a fuel that will allow spacecraft to be re-engineered, to travel many times faster than they ever have. Before, the amalgam of those elements would have just exploded, killing everyone on board. But now, if they can draw it from the atmosphere of Clytemnestra, well, you can imagine.
Hicks cleared his throat.
Thanks, Lieutenant. I think we've got the rest.
The usual, Hudson agreed. Put your asses in the shredder.
Don't be such a pussy, Hudson, Vasquez said. You gotta think long-term, hermano. They put 2 science teams down on this damn plateau and bugs killed them all. So they call the exterminators. That's us. Killing bugs is just good exercise, man.
And what do we get out of it?
Wurzbowski muttered.
Sergeant Apone glared at him.
For starters, you don't get court-martialed.
Dietrich breathed. Her nausea had all but vanished.
I'll tell you what you get, Wurzbowski, she said. Less time drifting around deep space waiting for some action.
Even Hicks smiled at that.
What do we know about these bugs? Malenka asked.
The Colonial Marines tended to call any non-humanoid alien species bugs, but she'd have liked a little more to go on before encountering this batch for the first time.
Not a hell of a lot, Apone grumbled. What I can tell you is that you're gonna need exosuits in this atmosphere.
Shit, Hudson whined. I hate those damn things. It's like trying to fight covered in wet wool. They'll slow you down a little, Lieutenant Paulson admitted. She glanced meaningfully around at the gathered Marines. But they'll also be the only thing keeping you alive. Nah, Lieutenant, Vasquez said, smiling grimly. It's my guns that'll keep me alive. Half a dozen Colonial Marines cheered, and this time the officers didn't try to quiet them down. Dietrich saw Apone shoot Paulson a worried look, and for a moment her stomach felt a little queasy again. She didn't like that look, not in the least. Honey, Khan called from the pilot's seat. We're home. The dropship touched down hard, skidded a few feet in Clytemnestra's high winds, and then came to a halt. Dietrich had bitten her lip, and the copper tang of her own blood flooded her mouth. Great, she thought. Not even out of the ship and already wounded. It should have been funny, but she couldn't find the humor in it. I've got movement, Zeller said, holding the motion tracker out in front of him as if it were some kind of shield. Dietrich swept the barrel of her pulse rifle from side to side, but the dust and grit of Clytemnestra's atmosphere scoured the goggles of her exosuit, making it hard to see. She'd been caught outside in a blizzard once, and the effect had been similar. A gust blasted her from behind, and she staggered, cursing this damned moon, where the air couldn't seem to make up its mind. The wind shifted direction by the second. That might have had something to do with their position on a mountain plateau. Ridges of stone climbed 30 feet higher to the north and west, so it felt almost as if they were inside a broken bowl.
I see nothing, Wurzbowski snapped, sweeping with his own motion sensor. Not a blip on this thing.
The unit spread in a circle, all turned outward, the whole group moving together. Dietrich scuttled sideways to keep her back to the unit, wind tugging at her pulse rifle.
I've got multiples now, Zeller barked. Northwest, coming our way. Up high, Sergeant Apone shouted. You saying these things are flying?
Dietrich saw it then, slicing through the air. Just a glimpse of it, thin and wraith-like, body open to catch the wind as it glided toward her. She muttered a stream of profanity into her comm unit and pulled the trigger, firing a plasma burst that lit up the dust storm like lightning high up in a thunderstorm. The thing banked left, somehow made itself smaller, and then plummeted toward the ground, headed for her face. She dropped, rolled right, came up onto one knee with her weapon aimed at the spot where the thing had alighted. It stood 6 feet away, and for a few heartbeats they were eye to eye, Dietrich and this creature unlike any she'd ever seen. Despite what she'd seen overhead, the bug stood tall and thin, its limbs like razors. Its body seemed smooth and black, glassy as volcanic rock. She counted two sets of eyes, both covered by a gossamer membrane which seemed to screen out the dust and grit of the atmosphere. Gunfire punched the air around her. Zeller shouted about incoming bugs. Wurzbowski kept insisting he didn't see anything on his sensor. As Dietrich pulled the trigger, the wind roared across the plateau and nudged her to the left, throwing off her aim. Plasma bursts tore up the rocky ground near the bug, and it shot her a look that might have been nothing more than curiosity. Then it opened like a flag unfurling. The wind took it, blew it backward and upward, and it angled its body so that it was soaring high out of range, in the space between one breath and another. Holy shit, Dietrich whispered into her comms. Cynthia, a voice said, and she snapped her head around, distracted by the use of her first name. Stenbeck, of course. Even behind the goggles and inside that exosuit, she saw the way he looked at her. I'm fine, she said.
You can't hesitate like that, he warned. Could have gotten yourself...
Hudson backed toward them, firing off into the darkness, the bursting plasma rounds interrupting them.
Can you two hump each other later, he said. Like after we kill all these damn locusts, or whatever they are?
More shouting, more weapons fire, more shapes knifing through the atmosphere. Wierzbowski complained again about his sensor until Spunkmeyer finally slapped it out of his hand.
It's broken, idiot. Use your goddamn eyes instead.
Laughter all around.
Shitbowski.